couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. That's right. I am the internationally recognized film critic, Kevin Carr. I'll tell you about that in a second, why I have finally earned that title. But right now, we're going to tell you what's coming up on the show. We've got reviews of 22 Jump Street, How to Train Your Dragon, Dos, Words and Pictures, and Lullaby, a more realistic cancer movie than what we had last week. We also have news. We have the trailer park, some box office prediction, and the DVD roundup. If you want to get a hold of me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And finally, if you want to find me on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr. Before we get into the news, I'll tell you why I'm an internationally recognized film critic now. I will be attending the Jerusalem Film Festival in July. I've been invited there as a guest to cover the film festival. So you'll actually get live reports from on the ground. And it's actual Jerusalem, Israel. I mean, it's not like Jerusalem, Texas or something like that. It's the honest to God Jerusalem. So I'll be flying over there and covering the film festival, and you'll be getting some reviews of that. You're going to be hearing some of the stuff that's actually happening overseas and from an entertainment context. So it's, you know, not as depressing as the news that normally comes from overseas in various areas of the world.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
And that's right. We move on into the news category. But first of all, I'm going to say this before anyone sort of snarks at me or gets mad at me. I know there's a DC Comics news out. Supposedly, Warner Brothers had leaked its scheduled list of movies of what they're going to be releasing over the next 4 or 5 years. I'm not covering that. Why? Because it's a rumor. They'll confirm all this at Comic-Con in about a month. And then we'll deal with it then. I'm not going to deal with rumor right now. Plus, the source comes from one of the most seedious, odious people in Hollywood, and I'm not going to send info that person's way. But let's talk about stuff that is confirmed. Sigourney Weaver is going to be in 3 Avatar sequels. Her character's not announced. If you recall from the first movie, she was a human who was also a Na'vi and then died and possibly came back and made connections. I actually have a lot to say about Avatar, and we're going to talk about that in the 4th segment in the talking points, because I think there's a lot of stuff happening with Avatar because it's starting to get ramped up. I don't think everybody is realizing kind of the full implications of what might happen with these movies. Couple other smaller news. Sonic the Hedgehog is getting a movie. Now, Sonic is one of the most recognizable video game mascots around for the Capcom gaming system, Sega Genesis. And that's true, but you know who else was recognizable was Mario from Mario Brothers. And they made a movie of him, and that was terrible. Of course, that movie, I don't know what was going on with that movie. That was one of those weird 80s to 90s glitches. I don't know. Hedgehog the movie might be okay. It's going to be a kid's movie. It's going to be CGI. Everyone's hoping they're going to make the next Lego movie, and I don't think they will. Another movie that is getting a sequel now is Neighbors. This was a no-brainer. When a movie does as well as Neighbors did, they're going to do a sequel. So they're talking about doing a sequel. Here's the problem, though. What do you do for a sequel? I mean, unless you take totally different characters. But I think that the story between Seth Rogen's character and Zac Efron's character is kind of wrapped up. You know, if you saw the movie, the story ends. And yeah, there are times when you can make a sequel that actually works if it's either a prequel, like when they did 300, when they did 300 Rise of an Empire. That was actually kind of an interesting way of handling it. I took my son to see 22 Jump Street, and I was explaining to him why sequels tend to not be very good. And I used Neighbors as an example, because I'd taken him to that one, too. And I was explaining to him that you have these characters that kind of tell this complete story, and how do you do this? And I said, what if they made a Neighbors sequel? And I knew they would, because it made too much money to not. And I'm like, is like Zac Efron going to work for Seth Rogen now? Is there going to be another frat that moves next door? The only thing you can guarantee that if Seth Rogen's involved, he's just going to be smoking pot at some point in the movie. That's the only thing you know is going to happen. But my prediction is a Neighbor sequel is going to be really forced. And sort of the shtick now is to do a sequel, and they kind of do this with 22 Jump Street. I'm teasing my review here in a bit. They take a sequel as sort of sending up the original, or purposely making it exactly like the original and then smiling at the audience and going, ah, see, we get it. But I don't think that works. I think that's going to be something that's indicative of this generation, of this era of filmmaking, because you had that with The Hangover. When The Hangover sequel first came out, it was kind of a, we're going to do the exact same thing only in Bangkok instead of Las Vegas. I think that joke only lasts so long. The next piece of news is The Walking Dead, even though this is TV. I'm just pointing this out because I hate The Walking Dead. I just do not like the show. It's the most boring show on television. It's more boring than when you had the Christmas log and you could watch the fireplace. That had more action in it than The Walking Dead. But The Walking Dead, apparently, they've got it figured out through season 12. Season 12! What is this, the Lawrence Welk show? The 12 seasons of The Walking Dead. How long is this apocalypse supposed to last? I know, if you're a fan, great. You'll have plenty of walkers for the next, 7 or 8 years now. Anyways, that's it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's move on into the trailer park. That's the sound. Here we are backing up. There's two of them I want to highlight, and they're depressing. So you may want to go take your Xanax before you listen to this. The first one is Dumb and Dumber 2, which opens on November 14th. That trailer just dropped this week.
It's a postcard from Freda Felcher.
Harry,
I'm pregnant. Please call me.
What do you think it means, Harry?
Lloyd, I'm going to be a dad.
Ah!
Look at the postmark.
1991. I had a daughter. I gave her up for adoption.
What if we go track her down?
You're hot for my daughter.
What?
Am I right?
What?
Am I right?
That's insane.
This is exactly what I feared a Dumb and Dumber sequel would be. I will give them credit. They are not going the route of just making fun of them doing a sequel. But my God, this was the movie that kind of launched the Farrelly brothers' career. And this is the movie that put Jim Carrey into superstardom 20 some years ago. I'm okay with them bringing something back for a revival. But this is going to be like the Ghostbusters 3. Whenever that thing gets off the ground, it's just going to be depressing to watch. Because you're going to be like watching the movie and you're going to be like thinking, oh, that was kind of funny. But remember that really funny part in the first movie when it was fresh and different? Plus the Farrelly brothers. I really honestly think the Farrelly brothers have lost their steam. I think they've lost their edge and their touch. Their last like 4 or 5 movies have been not just bad. They've been terrible. I mean, the best movie, that when you can say the best thing that you directed in the last 5 or 6 years is the Three Stooges, that's a bad thing. They don't have a handle on this anymore. This could be very funny. I chuckled a couple times in the movie. And maybe it's a check your brain at the door. And if it works, it works. I still think Jeff Daniels is very, very funny in this role. We'll just see what happens. We'll see if this can carry it on. No pun intended. The next one we're going to talk about, I'm just going to play the trailer. Because I don't even want to announce what it is.
There's a lot of things about our village that people don't know about. A lot of things that, we like to keep private. If it's real history you want to see, you need to see the Stones of the Gods.
What is that thing?
Twatha De Dana.
What does that mean?
Leprechaun.
Yeah, it's Leprechaun. Leprechaun Origins. This one comes out August 26th. And it's. I wish you could see it because, you know, obviously this is a radio, so you can't see what's going on the screen of the trailer. But it says something like the origin of a horror icon. And I'm like, wait, since when was Warwick Davis, the Leprechaun, a horror icon? I mean, when you say horror icons, you're talking Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, Chucky, Pinhead. These are iconic characters. Hasn't the Leprechaun always kind of been a joke? I mean, it has. The best one was the first one, and that one wasn't very good. I guess it's not that bad. They're not treading on sacred ground. I mean, the original Halloween was brilliant. And so when Rob Zombie made his absolute terrible bucket of poo that he called a movie, it was terrible because it did tread on a classic. There's no classic with Leprechaun. It opens, oddly enough, in August. I don't know why they don't open it in March, because that's when Leprechauns are most heard about. Anyways, we need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking words and pictures and lullaby. Because we can.
Oh,
Kevin Carr here with Fat Guys of the Movies, coming back at you, ready to take the world by storm. You know what's the funniest part about this whole Jerusalem Film Festival thing? I'm flattered. I'm incredibly flattered. The Jerusalem Press Club's bringing me out there, and I'll be not too far from the Cinematheque, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great. I'm going to check out the old city. I mean, it's just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But I do have to laugh at the fact that this is all surrounding my trip is going to be a fat guy in the desert in July. This is not going to end well for me. I'm going to come back. I'll have lost 50 pounds when I come back, and it'll all be water weight. I'll look like a mummy on the plane ride coming back, just because there's no way I'm going to be able to drink water fast enough to replenish the sweat that's coming out. So that'll be fun. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all that kind of thing to see what I have in store for the Jerusalem Film Festival. And of course, I mean, I don't think they're going to be playing Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is opening while I'm there. But still, I'll be talking about these films that you probably haven't heard of, or it'll broaden your mind. It's a good thing. Anyways, let's move on to the movies I'm going to review this week. First one is Words and Pictures. An alcoholic literature teacher at a private school finds himself at odds with the new art teacher, whose personal medical condition has impacted her ability to paint.
We're so glad that you chose our little town.
I didn't choose.
But moving from New York to the country.
You want to know why I moved out of the city?
Interesting. Because I have no curiosity at all about your private lives.
My name's Jack Marcus. Kids call me Mr. Mark.
In this class, we're interested in art. Don't trust the words. The words are lies.
So, words are lies, and pictures are?
Do I have to actually say it?
Now, this movie stars Clive Owen and Juliette Binoche. And the one thing that stuck out to me when I saw the movie is this is made for a certain type of person. And that certain type of person is somebody who will fold their hands and go, oh, yes, that Juliette Binoche is just wonderful. If that is who you are, you're going to love this movie. Because she's really good, and I mean, she is. She does a fine job. Clive Owen's fine too, but I don't know how many old ladies are sitting there going, "Oh, that Clive Owen, he's perfectly sweet and charming." I mean, they probably like him, but it's Binoche's movie. It's her, and that's actually part of the problem. Binoche, I think, is the draw for a movie like this because she brings a certain crowd to a film like this. Clive Owen, he's fine. He's passable. He does an okay job in the role, but I don't know how many people are out there demanding to see a Clive Owen movie or going out, who'd go out of their way to watch a movie with Clive Owen. They might go out of their way to watch a movie with Clive Owen trying to woo Juliette Binoche. That's the difference. And my back goes up when a film like this comes out. And the reason is because it takes place in a private school and there's, you know, high art and he's doing literature. So there's sort of this intellectual snobbery that sort of permeates the movie. And you get that with films like Admission. Do you remember that film last year with Paul Rudd and Tina Fey? She played a Princeton College applications officer. And another one it reminds me of is Smart People. Smart People was a fine enough movie, but the whole point was they were a bunch of intellectual poopy heads. I'm being kind on the radio, but they're snobby and elite. And I don't like that in a person. I certainly don't like that in the characters I watch in movies. So the movie does kind of look down on you, but what it allows the audience, if you're yourself a personally, you know, snobby, artistically inclined, high literature, oh, I only watch PBS kind of person. You can watch this movie and chuckle and be like, oh, ha, ha, ha. This is for people like me. This is a romantic comedy for enlightened people. So it does have that snooty air to it. And I didn't particularly like that. I'm lowbrow at times. I'm all for intellectual pursuits, but I'm very lowbrow about a lot of them as well. My biggest problem was, again, it's meant to be Binoche's movie and the way they construct it. But ultimately, the story is about Clive Owen. And his character is so trite. He's an alcoholic English teacher who has trouble keeping it in his pants and is ready to lose his job over it. I mean, that's like every movie that's ever made about professors in college. And the only difference is it's not in college. It's in a private high school. So while her character is far more interesting as a woman who's got rheumatoid arthritis, who is trying to continue to paint and further her career and overcome the bitterness that she has. And then you've got Clive Owen, who's just drinking himself into a stupor, going through every single cliche to the point that there's a scene. He has a previous relationship with like somebody in the administration, played by Amy Brenneman. And when that's revealed, I'm kind of like, sat there and I'm like, really? That's the next cliche we're throwing at me. Why don't you have them sleep with a couple students while you're at it? Well, you can't because they're in high school. So ultimately, Words and Pictures is perfectly charming. It's much more for the intellectual crowd, not necessarily for me. I'm going to say it kind of sucks, though, because that's the way I am.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. Next up, we're going to be talking about Lullaby here on Fat Guys of the Movies. This is Kevin Carr. Lullaby is a smaller film, and it's about a family that gathers for the final days of a father who is dying of cancer.
You can't just waltz back in here, Jonathan, and start acting like
I'm
you
not
care.
Acting
Would
like
you
anything?
Two just stop?
It's like being at home.
Jonathan?
Emily.
How is he? Is he all right?
Not really.
I'm Meredith. Got a light?
Are you kidding me?
What? Am I gonna get cancer?
Look, I think it's best if we all just lubricate our feelings. We won't just get through this. I can do this.
Is he always this selfish?
Yeah.
Now, this is this week's cancer movie. Last week we had The Fault in Our Stars, and this week we have Lullaby. And Lullaby, the biggest hurdle that it comes across is it's about Garrett Hedlund's character, and he's the son, and he's at odds with the sister, and he's kind of at odds with his parents as well, and it's everyone having to kind of get together and deal with the fact that their dad's dying. And it's not going to be a pretty death, and it's going to be drawn out, and deciding whether, and there's discussions of euthanasia, or even just taking him off the machines, not even like specifically, assisted suicide, but just letting him drop off. So it opens up that can of worms to contemplate. And so it is kind of Garrett Hedlund's movie, but at times it's trying to be him reconciling all of these things in his life when really it should be him reconciling his relationship with his family. But he's got like an old girlfriend out there played by Amy Adams. And there's actually kind of a sweet little story about another girl who is in the cancer ward who befriends him, and they sort of have this relationship. And actually, I found that one very intriguing, but it's like 15% of the movie, and I wanted to see more of that. But I will give it this. This movie shows an accurate representation of what cancer does, and it shows the pain and the struggles that the family goes through and the issues that they're facing, and that not just the big issues of, you know, whether or not, you know, assisted suicide or taking them off the machines, but just dealing with the nurses at the station. Because there's going to be tension there as well. And so it has a really good cast. I mean, like I said, you got Richard Jenkins as the father, Ann Archer as the mom, you got Jennifer Hudson as the nurse, Amy Adams. It's a fantastic cast. It's again, it's not really my kind of movie, but I'll tell you, I've had relatives die of cancer, and this is the kind of crap you have to go through. You don't go to the Anne Frank house and then, you know, just see your friend, you know, once, and then that's The Fault in Our Stars was Mickey Mouse. And I had a friend online who said that movie was, the plot was so thin. I go, the only thing not thin in that movie were the cancer patients. So this one's a realistic view if you really want to see what happens. So all you people who went out and saw The Fault in Our Stars last week because you want to romanticize cancer, go buy a ticket and go see Lullaby, or wait till it comes out on demand, because then you can really see what this stuff does. And yeah, it's not a teenager, that doesn't matter. This is cancer. So I think that this is a much more realistic view. I'm actually going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
We got to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about 22 Jump Street and How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Down on Jump Street.
Kevin Carr, Fat Guys of the Movies, coming at you with more movie reviews, talking sequels this time around. Get through all that original nonsense. Let's move on to the reason why Hollywood exists, and that's sequels and franchises. This segment, we're going to be talking about two movies that have a two in them. The first one, actually, one of them has two twos in it. They go above and beyond. They just don't do one two. They do two twos, and that would be 22 Jump Street. And in 22 Jump Street, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill return as somewhat youthful-looking cops, this time infiltrating a college drug ring.
Well, I hoped never to see you again.
What's up, dog?
We're back.
We in here!
Ladies, nobody cared about the Jump Street reboot, but you got lucky.
We in here!
So now this department has invested a lot of money to make sure Jump Street keeps going. The only problem is the Koreans bought the church back, so we're moving you across the road to 22 Jump Street.
Now, before I really talk about this movie, let's talk about the last movie. And I find it funny, just to begin with, that there is a movie that is a sequel to a reboot of an 80s TV show, and one of the companies that produced it is called Original Film. It's not. It's a rehash of a rehash. That's just curious to me. But back when the first 21 Jump Street came out 2 years ago, I was thinking this was going to be just freaking terrible. I thought it was going to be awful. I thought it was going to be stupid. I swerved into 21 Jump Street, the TV show, back in the late 80s, early 90s, a couple times. It's one of the films that kind of launched the Fox Network, along with Married with Children eventually came along. And those very early shows in Living Color and The Simpsons were very, very early shows on the network. I never really watched it, but it was a kitschy show. A lot of kids did, and I knew people who did. I just thought it was going to be terrible. But then I went and saw the movie, and I was like, this is a fun movie. This is a funny movie, the first 21 Jump Street. Part of it is Channing Tatum. While I don't think the guy's a good dramatic actor, I think the guy really is a good comedic actor. I think he's got a real talent for comedy. He's got amazing timing. He's game to do a lot of things. And working with Jonah Hill played a very excellent foil for him in that film. And plus they made it R-rated, and they made it really kind of over the top. They had some great small parts, not really cameos, by Nick Offerman and Ice Cube. So when this new one came around, here's the problem with expectations. I was expecting and hoping that it was going to be as good as the first. I went in the first one with really low expectations. I was pleasantly surprised. I went into this one with high expectations, and I was kind of disappointed. Because it rehashes pretty much the first movie. And I get what they're doing. They're winking and nodding at the audience and saying, we know that we don't have an original story here. Just go with it. We're just trying to make you laugh. And I've seen that done in movies before. The Hangover did it. The Austin Powers, the sequel to Austin Powers, the first one, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. There is literally a point in that movie where Michael York breaks the fourth wall, looks at the audience and says, look, this is just a stupid movie. Go with this. We're not going to provide you with a really decent explanation for this. He's stealing his mojo and he's time traveling. This makes no sense. I get where that joke comes from, but I still think it's lazy writing to use that as a patch. And they kind of do in 22 Jump Street. It's not as funny as the original. It doesn't organically fit together. It still has some very funny moments. And actually, some of the best moments in the entire film are when it's sort of self-referential to it being a sequel. And if you know, in the trailer, you hear it in the trailer and you've seen the trailer where they're referencing the fact that, oh, now to keep Jump Street alive, we're still going and we're throwing more money at it. And they have a lot of jokes at its own expense. And those tend to be very funny. But they do get overused a bit. Although I'll tell you, when they really are on with some of the jokes, they're really on. And I'll tell you, if you go see it, stay through the credits, because there is a fantastic sequence right when the credits start rolling that shows they understand how movies work and they kind of play with it. The problem was having too many references in the movie. And also, they'd have jokes that they wouldn't let go. And there's a certain rule in comedy that if you do something once, it's funny. If you do it three times, it's funnier. If you do it beyond that, it is no longer funny. But if you push ahead and continue to do it, eventually it becomes so funny again, it becomes hilarious. And that doesn't work with everything. And I think that's what they try and do with the old jokes, because Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill can't pass for 20 years old anymore. Neither of them can. And they're making jokes about them being old, and they just keep going and hammering away. And the jokes, they're different jokes, but it's no longer funny. It's like, okay, I get it. It's sort of like telling fat jokes. At a certain point, you're saying, okay, fat jokes, I get it. I'm overweight. You can stop with the fat jokes. So while this has some laughs to it, it just doesn't work as well as the first movie did. And I think they knew that going in, which is why they wrote it the way they did. It's still probably going to make money. Oh, one other thing with it is it kind of culminates. There's a, and you see this in the trailers, if you watch the trailers and even on the posters, it sort of has this climax at spring break. And it feels like they were going to release it in like March, which is what they did with the first movie. I believe that one was a spring movie. But they realized that one did so well, this should be able to hold on in the summer. And it just seems really out of place to be doing a spring break sequence in June, especially since it seems like they're trying to play off of spring break as a time. So ultimately, I'm actually going to have to say 22 Jump Street kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk about How to Train Your Dragon 2. Hiccup and Toothless come back for this high-flying sequel about finding a new group of dragons, rediscovering lost family members, and saving the dragons from a threatening foe.
I bet you think you know a lot about dragons.
Should I know you?
No, but a mother never forgets.
Every dragon has its secrets. I'll show them all to you.
Something is coming. Something you've never faced before.
What's down there?
I alone control the dragons. Drago Bloodfist is a madman.
I'll buddy his fist with my face if he tries to take my dragon.
I know that How to Train Your Dragon, the first film, is beloved by a lot of film critics and audiences, and I enjoyed it. I gave it a positive review back when it came out 4 years ago. But I didn't love it. To me, it wasn't the beginning and end of animation. It wasn't, hey, this was not the point where I'm like, oh, Pixar has a run for their money. I didn't think it was as great as everybody else did. I still thought it was decent, but I didn't think it was great. Coming from somebody who just was okay on the first one, I really did enjoy this one. It's darker. It deals with some heavier subject matter. It deals with a nastier villain, I think. It's been a while since I've seen the first film, so I can't remember if the villain was as dangerous as the villain in this one was. But it has some pretty intense stuff. So it might be a little scary for kids. If they went to Maleficent and they enjoyed that and they didn't have a problem with that, I don't think you're going to have a problem with How to Train Your Dragon. And the visuals sometimes, there's a certain point where the visual ceases to be stunning and almost become too much. It's like sensory overload. And there's so much flying and swooping and movement that it's hard to take it all in at times. And you kind of get lost. And in fact, sometimes if I see movies and there's so much crap going on screen, it's almost like too much flickering and I almost want to go to sleep. And this does this a bit. So the animation's not perfect. It looks really good, but it does tend to overload my brain. It overloaded my brain a little bit. And trust me, the way I am nowadays, I'm in my 40s. It doesn't take much to overload my brain. I'm going to have an aneurysm if I were to watch this movie again. But I think it's a neat movie. And it actually has a story that moves and it doesn't drag. It has a bit of part in the middle. But I remember at one point looking at my watch and thinking, wait, is this over? This seems to be getting near the end. And it wasn't, it was sort of like at that second act climax. They weren't into the third act yet, but I really didn't feel like it had much time had passed. So it has a really good pace, great animation, some good voice casting, and it's ultimately a pretty good movie. So I'm going to say How to Train Your Dragon 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Especially since it's one of those rare movies that I thought was better than the first one. So there you go. How to Train Your Dragons, the better sequel, this weekend. All right, with that, I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about box office. I got a talking point about the Avatar sequels and, of course, the world-famous DVD Roundup. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are rolling into the final segment here. We're going to be talking about box office, some talking points about Avatar, talking about DVDs coming up here. So there's still a lot more. Stick with us because we got some interesting things to talk about. The first one, which I already kind of railed on earlier in the show when I was talking about Lullaby, is the box office. The Fault in Our Stars, I predicted $35 million because I said that's the kind of world we live in, that this crappy movie is going to win. And it did win, but it did it with a lot more than $35 million. It made $48 million over the weekend. That's just sick. No pun intended. But I'll tell you, this movie peeved me. And here's why. Because that $48 million, part of that was coming from tickets sold on Thursday night for this event. Because they made like $8 million on Thursday night, which contributed to a 20-some million dollar first day. And then I found, I'm like, wow, that's like big tentpole release numbers. And then it comes out that, oh, they had this $25 a ticket event, Fault in Our Stars, where they did this event, and I think it was this satellite Q&A. Here's the problem. I don't think you should be able to count that. This is sort of like when Kevin Smith released Red State, a very different movie, but he released it by four-walling it into his own Evening with Kevin Smith and charging like $50 or $70 or whatever it was for a ticket to the event. And then it counted as the box office. I'm like, no, that doesn't count as the box office. It shouldn't. And we run into that too when you see Groupon sales, when there's big Groupon events, and then you'll get a lot of sales, but then you'll actually have a depressed number for gross. I really think to get an accurate depiction, you take the entire Thursday night out, you still got a $40 million opening weekend, which is fantastic for a movie like this. But here's the other thing. That's fantastic for a movie. Part of the reason is because it cost $12 million to make. $40 to $48 million is fine for a big movie like Maleficent, or even if Edge of Tomorrow could have managed that, it would have been okay. But you know, the part of the reason this movie is going to become a big hit is because it's low cost, high returns. But here's the thing. I guarantee you, you're not going to be able to make any movie from this point on with Shailene Woodley for $12 million. That's going to be her salary in everything she does from now on. I don't know what she's negotiated for Insurgent and the Divergent sequels, but I guarantee you she's going to be asking for bigger and bigger bucks. I don't think she picks movies that are as good. Jennifer Lawrence is that juggernaut. And Jennifer Lawrence picks movies, and she knows what she's doing, and she's good at them. And yes, she's in some movies like House at the End of the Street, but she's also in fantastic movies as well. And Shailene Woodley has not been in a fantastic movie for a couple years, if ever. This weekend, I think How to Train Your Dragon 2 is going to win $60 million. That's my prediction. I'm actually going lower than some people. Some people are predicting 70 or more. I just get a sense that the people making the projection, the first How to Train Your Dragon was beloved by a lot of people, and a lot of them are critics and box office people. And sometimes I think some people are a little too close to their numbers. And there's some people who want How to Train Your Dragon to be the biggest movie of the summer. I actually have seen people suggest it's going to be the biggest movie of the summer. I don't think it will. I think it's going to do well. It's going to be fine. And this is going to be a fine weekend. This is not going to be a disappointment whatsoever. But How to Train Your Dragon 2 is not going to be the juggernaut that even something like Despicable Me 2 was. I think it's going to have a good, healthy run. But I think the people doing the predicting, when they are too emotionally tied, they sometimes get a little bit too close to it. The other thing, you got Transformers 4 coming up. And it's coming up. And here's the thing. Transformers 4 is coming up in a vacuum. The week before it is like Jersey Boys. That's going to have no audience conflict whatsoever. And then there's nothing really on the 4th of July to conflict with it either. You've got like a horror movie and you've got Tammy, which is a comedy. But you don't have any real competition for Transformers 4. Transformers 4 is going to play like Transformers 2, where it's going to be unprecedentedly good box office and probably not be that good of a film, but it's just going to be benefiting from this vacuum that has emerged around it, which is exactly what happened in 2009, when Transformers 2 came out. It just happened to be the movies that preceded it were movies that weren't huge hits. I think like Land of the Lost was one of them. And they thought that was going to be a big hit and it just kind of died. That kind of paved the way for Transformers to do well. So that's what I think. $60 million for How to Train Your Dragon 2. We'll see what happens next week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The talking point I want to talk about now, and this is more about box office, Avatar, they're ramping up for those three sequels and they're going to film them concurrently. They're going to do them the way they were doing with the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies, and it's going to be boom, 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 one right after the other. Here's the difference. What if the first Avatar is not a monster hit? What if it just does well? What if it's like The Amazing Spider-Man 2? That's something to think about, and here's why. This is not The Fault in Our Stars, which is a $12 million budget, so anything over $20 million at opening weekends guarantees that it's just going to be profitable from the get-go. These are going to be massively expensive movies. Massively expensive movies, because they need to be, because they're following up Avatar. It's not going to be like Lord of the Rings, where it was $100 million each, run and gun, boom, you're done. Each Avatar sequel is going to have a budget of like $250 to $300 million. In fact, the original reports for shooting in New Zealand alone They're talking about being contractually obligated to spend $400 to $500 million just on that. We're not talking about all the post-production and the standard James Cameron cost overruns that come up with every movie he's done and all the digital work that's going to be done outside of New Zealand. So bottom rung is going to be a $500 million price tag. What if they're not massive hits? Because I remember doing an interview back in 2009, right before Avatar came out, and the host asked me, they're like, is this going to ruin James Cameron's career? Because it was obviously the most expensive movie at the time being reported. And I said, look, it has to do better than Titanic to save him. It has to make $1 billion just to break even. And it did. It ended up, he rolled the dice. But they're rolling the dice three times on this massive budget. Here's the other thing. The first Avatar was innovative. 3D was relatively new. It was just getting into the marketplace. This fully rendered environment hadn't been fully realized yet. Motion capture technology was still getting a foothold. These had great rewatch value. You get this stuff now with like Maleficent, which is a big movie, but it's still not huge. You know, it's not Avatar. And I think by now, the 3D hitch, which is what, that's the kicker that got Avatar to a wide audience, was the 3D. I always heard people say, I don't like 3D, but I'll watch Avatar in 3D. I think people are fatigued on 3D, and I love 3D. But I think by the time 2017 rolls around, even overseas, it's not going to be the novelty it was in 2009 and early 2010. He was going to do in a high frame rate. That never caught on with The Hobbit. Nobody cares. And we're also in a different world than we were in 2009, 2010. I have a friend who bought a 70-inch television set. That's obscenely large. And you can have that with 3D in a home theater and completely control your environment. You're getting closer and closer to the home theatrical experience. No question, Avatar is going to make a lot of money. But it needs to make a metric crap ton of money to justify its existence. All right, with that, we need to roll into the DVD roundup. The spotlight this week is Mitchell. Not the original movie. Well, kind of the original movie. This stars Jodan Baker and John Saxton, Merlin Olsen. He's a cop who's chasing drug dealers. This is a terrible movie made in 1975, I think. The way to watch it is Mystery Science Theater version. This is the last episode with Joel Robinson. Joel Hodgins left the show at this time. And it introduced Mike Nelson as the new host. It also has been unavailable for a while on DVD. It was in the big box set that they released for Mystery Science Theater, like 20th anniversary last year. You can now get it on Amazon for like $3.99. It's great. It's a classic episode that a lot of people haven't seen. Other DVDs that are new this week, we've got Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit. I like that movie better than most people did. I enjoyed it. It was a fine January release. Was not going to justify another one to be made because it just didn't make back its budget. There's also Nonstop, a big, exciting film with Liam Neeson kicking butt, which was not perfect, but again, for like an early year release with Liam Neeson, it was good. Alan Partridge, the movie, we covered that a couple weeks ago when it came out in the theatrical release. It's now available on Blu-ray and DVD. Funny movie if you like Alan Partridge, if you like British humor, and it has a little bit of nods to the style of Hot Fuzz as well. So check that one out. There's Visitors, which is from Cinedigme, and it's by the people who did Koyaanisqatsi. So it's visual poetry. It's a lot of imagery and that sort of thing. So that's sometimes a challenge to watch. There's True Detective Season 1. All I know, I don't watch this show because I don't have HBO, but all I know is that Alexander Daddario shows her boobs in it. So I did Google that at one point and watched it for science. For science. I take this stuff seriously, people. I need to watch this stuff to make sure it's good for you. And then there's also Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, which is, of course, the Neil deGrasse Tyson remake of the Carl Sagan series from the 70s. Fantastic episodes. Really good to sort of distill science, modern science, down for people who maybe don't understand it or didn't do too well in school. It's a great accessible look at science and the scientific history. That's it. We need to wrap up here. We are done. Next week, we're going to be talking Jersey Boys and Think Like a Man 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.